So today's service takes its name from Psalm 118. And Psalm 118 is a psalm of deliverance, a song of thanks for victory in battle. It speaks to Israel's precarious, vulnerable geography lying at the crossroads of travel routes between Asia, Europe, and Africa. As such, Israel was often attacked or threatened. Sound familiar? The psalmist writes, "God, I thank you that you have answered me and have become my salvation. The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it." The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone.
So sometimes the stories that others share about us show us in a brighter light, a more righteous light than we would choose to show ourselves. The storytellers, they are the ones that love us, that see in us something of worth and meaning, that hold us with that agape love, unconditional, just like the love that the universe shines on us, or that the Hebrew people were shining on their God with this psalm of praise. My mother is the teller of these stories for me.
Oh boy.
Reverend Scott has learned to tune out when it's Anya story hour in the Samler house.
I don't tune it out. I just prepare my... She speaks slowly and softly, and the stories are very long.
And good. Really good. I'm an only child. My mother spins tales of my father and her mother, but I am the usual suspect, and the stories do go on for quite some time. These stories, they're all part true and part love. And the part love part has its own kind of truth to it. There's one she tells of the stone wall outside our house. We have one of those New England stone walls that's been there for many years, and it's held together just by the tension that the weight of the stones build among themselves. And one day my mother was out there weeding around this stone wall, and one of those large stones fell on her hand. And she was stuck there because she didn't have enough strength in her other hand to lift the stone by herself. And so she called out and she called for me. And I was a young child at the time, but as the story goes, I came running and was there immediately and reached down and forgot all my childish ways and lifted the stone and carried it off of her hand. And it was a miracle.
You turned it into gravel too, right?
I did, yes. I only remember the story in my mother's voice. I think I have an image or two from the day, maybe, but who's to say? It's really been preserved for me, not by me. It is a story of the way that we can act at times in the interest of others without pause or deliberation, simply because it is necessary and good, simply because we have been called. I'm glad to have this story of me because being human, and no matter what my mother believes, I am quite human. I often struggle to grasp every stone that I should grasp. I pause, I deliberate, and at times I turn away from those metaphorical stones that need my attention, my vigilance, the stones that might just be the cornerstones, the strength, the stability, the hope that I and others need. The other evening, I was walking home alone at dusk from a restaurant in our town, and there are many homeless men and women that call our town their home, but I was still surprised to see one in a place that I'd never seen a man sitting before that late at night. He was sitting on a step on the way home at this apartment complex, and at first, I just walked past him, and I nodded as I went, sort of a nod to say hello and to acknowledge his presence. But then, for some reason, a conviction moved in me, and I turned around. "Sir, do you have anywhere warm to go tonight?" "Oh, yes," he said. And as an afterthought, he added, "Thank you. Thank you for caring." Two things broke in my soul in those moments. The first, that blessing of connection, a real moment of connection, a blessing made far brighter in contrast to the number of times I have walked past others, fearful, deliberating, what should I say? Afraid to make that goodwill gesture, afraid to lift the stone. Amen. And the second thought that broke in my soul, what the heck would I have done if he had said no? Right? The stones that the builders, and you and I were the builders, the stones that the builders reject, refuse, those stones, those opportunities that might break our souls open with connection are not without complexity, not without danger, not without struggle. To choose them, we must choose to step into a struggle of not knowing because, simply because, we have been called.
Yes, you and I are builders. And you and I, we all are called to build and to be life preservers. Let me share a story of one life preserver from the Hebrew Scriptures, a tale of one rejected, the story of Joseph. Now, Joseph is the son of Jacob, who's the son of Isaac, who's the son of Abraham. Joseph was Jacob's most beloved son, born of his dearest wife, Rachel. Now, Joseph had 10 older brothers and one younger brother. Now, the elder brothers knew their father favored Joseph. What happens when siblings know the parents favor one child over another?
Jealousy.
Jealousy. And to make matters more interesting, Joseph was a dreamer. And he was touched by God, as the story goes, with being able to interpret dreams. Joseph's father, Jacob, made for him a robe with long sleeves. And he was the only one with such a robe. And this coat became known as his dream coat. And Joseph, who seems in the story to not only be without guile, he seems really naive about his brother's jealousy. He tells his brothers of these dreams that he has, like the one where the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars, brothers, are bowing down to him. Many of Joseph's dreams seem to involve his brothers bowing down to him, not likely to cure their jealousy, methinks. So one day when the elder 10 brothers are tending Jacob's flock, they see Joseph, who's 17, wandering around in his dream coat, checking up on them as his father had asked him to do. And they snap. And they conspire to kill him. And they throw him into a pit without any food and no water. But fearing the wrath of God and their father, they opt not to shed his blood. They sell him into slavery. Now, while in slavery, Joseph ends up in Egypt, first working for the captain of the guard in the Pharaoh's palace. But because of some other jealousy, Joseph ends up in prison. Now, while imprisoned, Joseph's cellmate is a man who upon release becomes a cupbearer for the Pharaoh. He brings him his wine. So as this former cellmate is serving the Pharaoh is sharing dreams that are perplexing and vexing him. Night after night, dreams of 7 fat cows and then 7 emaciated cows. And he can't figure it out, and none of the magicians at the court have any idea what these dreams are about. And the cupbearer, seeing Pharaoh vexed, he tells Pharaoh of his former cellmate, this Hebrew named Joseph, who was a grand interpreter of dreams. So Pharaoh calls for Joseph. He explains the dreams, and Joseph says, God has shown me what your dream means. There will be 7 years of abundance and 7 years of famine. Pharaoh, thoroughly convinced of the divine origin of the interpretation of this dream, not only heeds Joseph's message to prepare for famine, he puts Joseph in charge of the entire operation. From prison to second in command, the rejected becomes exalted. So the time of plenty comes, just as predicted, they store their bounty. The time of famine comes, right on schedule, and the people thrive because of Joseph's interpretation. Now, a couple years into the famine, Joseph's brothers come to Egypt seeking relief. They had heard that Egypt had prepared for the famine. His brothers now all think that Joseph is dead. So they come into the palace trying to buy grain. And what do? They all bow to him. Because he's the man they have to buy the grain from. Now Joseph, of course, recognizes his brothers as soon as they enter. But he doesn't reveal himself to them at first. In fact, he even will speak through an interpreter, pretending not to understand what they're saying to test them. And his brothers, unaware it's Joseph, thinking he cannot understand, they begin to lament to one another and to weep because they feel that the reason they are in despair is because of what they did to their brother, who they think is now dead. And hearing this, Joseph weeps. And he understands so much in this one moment. His own destiny, as well as what God had in store for him in the story. It all fit into something so much larger than human ambition or desire. His exile, his imprisonment, and his being exalted as the leader of the Egyptian economy were all part of a larger transcendent plan. And Joseph, overcome with affection, releases his Egyptian guards working with them because he doesn't want them to see him breaking down in tears. He's the chief. He has to maintain authority. So Joseph, once the guards are gone, reveals himself to his brothers as the one they sold into slavery 20 years prior. Everybody weeps and hugs each other. And Joseph helps them understand that something transcendent held them throughout the time, throughout the hatred, throughout the selling into slavery, throughout the famine, beyond their father's anguish. They were held by something immense and beautiful, something they chose to call God. Joseph is a life preserver. He doesn't just save one life, he saves the entire society. Like so many tales in the Hebrew scriptures, we are shown that religious work is about nothing short of reordering society into more just and equitable relationship. As the giver of justice for Pharaoh, Joseph says, and I can't believe I never really understood this before, I do this so that none will have to come to poverty. The state's obligation, according to Joseph's story, is to prevent poverty, to look out for the poor, the widow, and the orphan, to be kind to the immigrant. Because as the Hebrew scriptures will say later on, we were all once aliens in the land of Egypt. We have all been strangers somewhere. We have all been rejected. And we all deserve deliverance.
As it is true with so many aspects of life, the stories that happen on the outside in the world around us, they happen just as well on the inside. And often, sometimes the same words can be used. like poverty, like deliverance. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, says the poet Rumi. A joy, a depression, a meanness, he continues. Some momentary awareness comes, an unexpected visitor, like Joseph in his technicolor coat that we don't know what to do with yet. Welcome and entertain them all, says Rumi, even if they are a crowd of sorrows, who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. These are some of the stones we refuse as well, the stones of sorrow, of shame, of malice. Not all the stones meet us on the outside. Some come from within. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in, says our poet. Who is he kidding? Right? We're expected to be strong, right? When you leave your home for your office, you need to show up ready to get to work and to get things done, right? When you care for your families, they need you to be the sturdy one, right? The strong one, the parent, the grandparent that is consistent in your compassion, right? When you engage at social events, you can't show up sad or angry. Who will want to talk to the angry young man or the sad sack, right? When then? When can you meet the sorrow, the shame, the aches, these guests? When can you meet them and let them in? When I grow weary, when the darkness of these days, riddled with violence and fear, when my own expectations weigh on me, sorrow settles in. And my first response is to turn away, to refuse it, to reject it. If I ignore it, maybe it'll go away. Hide and seek, the post-adolescent version. If I let my mind grow numb with an inane movie or Facebook chatter, maybe the ache will just subside. Right? I see some nodding heads out there. But then I wake in the night and, Ollie, Ollie, Oxbury, ready or not, here I come, says the sadness. And now it is monstrous and looming. Right, you've been here. We learn again and again in our social life, in our work life, in our family life, that we need to be strong to defend ourselves against these guests, these aching guests. But we were never meant to be perfect, nor impermeable. When life was carved from carbon and nitrogen, complexity was born. Without diversity, life is impossible. Without hate, we would not understand the power of love. Without sorrow, we would not know the power of joy. Without shame, we could not taste the blessing of honor. This is not defeatist philosophy. This is complexity theory. When I wake in the night and sorrow is looming, the first task is to call it mine. To call it mine. When my father's father died, he cried, and the tears, they spilled like cisterns overflowing. He showed me that vulnerability was strength, because vulnerability was love, broken open and invited in, mine. This is paradox. And paradox serves us only when we meet our ache face to face, when we thank it, literally thank it for its presence, can it teach us the truth of who we are. And that truth is that we contain more love than we thought imaginable. That our hearts, they are wide and deep, vulnerable and vast, and inherently connected, interconnected to all life. The stones that we thought the world was throwing at us, they become the head cornerstones, our strength, our wisdom.
Vulnerability can be our strength. I had a hard time letting in the guests that needed to be let in one particular time in my life. The sorrows that visited me made me feel that love was no longer imaginable. I had lost a significant relationship. I was about to lose my house in Baltimore. And all I could think about was curling up, shutting the door, not calling any of my friends. This is me I'm talking about. Not calling any of my friends. And just wondering how I could be such a fool to let this happen to me. I chased away those pains that are really catalysts for transformation. So in the process of packing up my old home and moving to my new one, I got to my new house in Havre de Grace, Maryland. And I ended up unpacking the books that were on my desk for my house in Baltimore. And I noticed there was a pattern with these books. They were all about spirituality and the history of religion. Now, at the time, I wasn't a religious person. When I was a teenager, I became convinced in about, 1977, that religion was the biggest problem the world had. It was during the time of the rise of the moral majority, so-called. And it seemed to me that to be a religious person was to create permission for error to rule the land. But I didn't know that there were people such as you. I didn't know that there was something into which I could pour myself, through which I could find myself. I didn't know that if I followed where that pain and that sorrow led me, which was to the bookstore, imagine that, and to stay inside and to discover that there was something missing in my life. My reading list showed me what I was missing. And I ended up finding a Unitarian Universalist church, and the Reverend Lisa Ward, who is my home minister, who worked very quickly to kick me out of the nest and go to seminary. And this was my life preserver. The thing that I had rejected was being a religious person. And it wasn't until I was able to reclaim that important part of my humanity, to honor and serve an institution which honored my own genuine spiritual search and created what I like to call the mothership. This is our mothership of ministry. You're all ministers. We all come here together to celebrate the notion, as Joseph says, all people are my people. We come together to understand and to serve and to build the better world we know is waiting for us to show up and build it. Because we see one another in each other's eyes. And we know because of our own struggle. We know because of our own salvation, our own path, that we have come to a place where our natural response is gratitude. And to serve the holy as we understand it, so that no one need live in poverty, whether that's poverty of spirit or poverty of resources. So I ask you, continue to serve with us on that journey.
Meet those cornerstones and don't reject them. Amen.